All right, welcome into another exciting episode of That.
So, Cincinnati.
Phil Didion and his finger, Phil's finger, ready to roll, executive producer Phil Didion, and my co-host Sherry Coolidge. We're back. You're back, Sherry.
Hello.
Back in the booth, that is.
That's right.
Hello. Today's special guest is Charlie Norman, Cincinnati native, who now runs the Ohio Department of Motor Vehicles. That is not correct. It's the Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles, the Ohio BMV. He is the registrar of that, became that earlier this year when Governor Mike DeWine took office. So Charlie, we're going to bring him in as our special guest. First of all, we're going to jump and pull someone in from, go a little old school and bring someone in from our newsroom to talk about a story like we used to do. We used to bring in another reporter. So we're going to bring in investigative reporter James Pilcher. James?
Hey, guys.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
James, you got a big story coming up later this week, as our listeners will hear this on Wednesday when we post. And and you have a story coming up on Cincinnati.com later in the week, Thursday?
Yeah, probably overnight tonight, if today's Wednesday. So we'll probably post it after midnight tonight.
Oh, perfect.
And in the morning, it'll be there for everybody to read on Thursday morning.
James, you got a big story coming up on a home builder, and can you tell us what you're working on?
Sure. So let me back up, give you the background. Back in March, we got a complaint from a local couple looking for help. Sometimes we get these things from our readers, from people just looking for any kind of exposure. They've reached their wit's end because they have nowhere else to go. Nobody will listen to them. So we thought, when I first heard it, I thought it was just another run-of-the-mill consumer complaint. But I started to look into it, and then a lawyer who I know very well from actually handling civil rights cases took their case and actually filed suit. Basically, their home builder was really using aggressive legal tactics, not fulfilling the requirements of the warranty, and actually, when they tried to fix something, made their house structurally unstable, according to several inspection reports that I saw, and then refused to fix it when they got a lawyer. So it turned into this huge legal battle, and it turned into the typical David versus Goliath kind of battle, and I started to look into it, and I realized, first of all, this company is bigger than I ever could have imagined. The name of the company is Ryan Homes. They're a big name around here, but a lot of people don't know this. They're actually part of a national company that's publicly traded. It's one of the biggest companies in the country. They make 18,000 homes a year. They're making $800 million in profit. That's not revenue, that's profit. So they're making almost $1 billion in profits, and their shares are selling for $3,600 a share on the stock market. So this is big, big, big business, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started to look into it, and I realized, you know, some of these tactics that they're using are becoming more and more common as a way for these companies to avoid court. But there's a lot of people out there questioning whether or not it's fair to the average lower end consumer, especially in the home building arena, when this is the biggest purchase of your life. So
what's the premise? What are they doing?
So the two big things that they do are they get you to go to what's called either binding, forced, or some kind of arbitration outside of court. So you meet in front of an arbitrator, you present your case, they present their case, and the arbitrator says, okay, this is what we're going to do. But by agreeing to that, you have forfeited your rights to sue them. So you stay out of the court system. So there's a lot of people feeling that system is geared towards the home builders. The other thing that happens a lot of times, these home builders write that in the contract or write that in the warranty saying, if you have a problem with us, you can't sue us. You have to go here. So that just automatically precludes. And a lot of home builders don't read, homeowners or home buyers don't read that in the fine print. They don't know it until it's too late. And then the other thing that happens is that when you do reach these settlements, you can't talk about it. They shut everybody down with non-disclosure agreements, which, you know, have their place. But when it starts to become a major societal issue, and I'm paraphrasing experts, I'm not trying to opinionate here, but you know, the experts say when this starts to collectively become a bigger issue, there's a societal cost, and that the market is supposed to work off of information. But if the market doesn't know that information, it skews it towards one way or the other. So those are some of the bigger issues at play. That's what they're doing. I have experts calling it legal bullying. One expert liking it to your car breaking down on the highway and you going to the car maker or the car dealer and them saying, well, we'll only fix this much if you agree to this. And, oh, by the way, you can't tell anybody about it.
Hmm. You know, that's the thing. Like, not telling. This seems like it's kind of coming to light that this is happening in a lot of things. Like we're seeing this in the Me Too movement.
Right.
That a lot, you know, that you feel like you're all alone because you can't talk about it.
Right.
And it is a way to tamp down the idea that something is systemic. And I'm really interested to read your story, James. Everyone, you know, someone who lives in a Ryan home, everyone does. And like, and just you hear right. home building stories, of course. Anyone who's built a home has a story.
Right.
But I do. And, you know, we're seeing this at City Hall, you know, with like settlements of like when Harry Black left. And it's just like they're not allowed to talk about it. And so you don't know what's going on. And that's just, it's designed, you know, to keep things in the dark.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the Me Too movement because, you know, I actually talked to legal experts and they said that, you know, this has been a growing trend in business. The use of these arbitration and non-disclosures mm-hmm. has been a growing trend in business. But they said that it was the Me Too movement that opened everybody's eyes in the public to this. And if there's going to be any changes because of that, it's because when I talk about those societal costs, I'm talking about, okay, Harvey Weinstein kept shutting people up. You know, Epstein kept getting people to sign to shut everybody up. Well, if enough people are to shut up, it becomes, you know, you don't know, and there's a societal danger there. So, you know, that's one side of it, you know, the sexual abuse versus home building and questionable legal tactics and stuff.
What kind of things did you hear about Ryan Holmes?
Well, thank you for bringing that up.
That you chronicled in the story. Like, what were some of the issues?
So
that
one of the non-discloses, for example, we found a lawsuit in New York where the couple and their family were making some final tours of the house, and the wall fell on them. And the kid got hurt.
Oh, man.
So they sued. And they settled out of court. But because they signed a non-disclosure agreement, they couldn't talk to us about it. That kind of thing. All right? So I've found a couple in South Carolina where the workers in their brand-new house, their $500,000 house, didn't hook up the pipes from two of their toilets to the sewer. Oh, so it dumped all of the waste into a crawl space under their house for 10 months. And when they complained about it, a Ryan worker came out, said he went underneath the house. His white shirt wasn't dirty. He said, I found a piece of moldy cardboard. That's what's causing it. Well, they got their own private home inspector to come and look underneath there. He immediately realized what the problem was. The next day, you know, they had all these Ryan trucks out there, but the lady said, I was so mad. They only offered me $17,000 to clean it up and to make us go away at first. So she actually was able to talk about her case, but they did sign a non-disclosed in terms of how much they settled for.
You know, and honestly, when you're facing a home issue, like a big home issue, you know, that's like one of the worst moments of your life. That's where you live and you're dealing with it and it's a crisis and you're trying to deal with your life too. Well, you're not thinking, did this happen to somebody else?
Right.
You know, what's going on? You're just thinking about your own crisis and dealing with it.
Right. We found the local couple we really focused in on, they came in and their floor wasn't level in their dining room. And they came in and instead of replacing the warped floor, they're called floor joists, but they're pieces of wood that support the floor. Instead of replacing them, they cut them in half, jumped up and down, and then braced them. And that is completely against code. It is completely against any kind of, they didn't get any structural analysis done, nothing. So now the house is structurally, the structural integrity of the house is ruined. but because they hired a lawyer, they won't agree to come in and fix it. So these guys are sitting in a house without a certificate of occupancy. They're in their 30s. They've got three young kids. They're crying to me in front of a camera about, they said it's caused all kinds of strife in their marriage. It's caused all kinds of issues, and all because they wanted it in writing and all because they wanted it to go through their lawyer. Ryan backed up and said, nope, we can't talk to you. And now it's in court, and they were actually pushing it to federal court. Wow. So that's the kind of stuff you go up against. And as one person said, they have a lot of lawyers and you have one, and they're willing to wait you out. So, you know, we did work with reporters around the country on this. But, you know, there's a lot of, obviously, Ryan is a huge name here in the Cincinnati area. So that's kind of what we
James, let me ask you, do you know how many of those 18,000 homes of the that Ryan builds every year across the country, about how many of those are in greater Cincinnati?
Well, no, I tried to find that out, but it's hard to get it without just having to go through hand by by hand the building permits. I called the realtors. I called the home builders. The home builders are obviously not particularly happy I'm doing this story, the local home builders association. But they don't actually keep track. So I'd have to go through the actual building departments of each county to count the home, the housing permits and who did what. So that was a little bit beyond the purview of our story. Now, I'm hearing, you know, that Ryan isn't the only one. These practices are fairly common. The legal practices are fairly common throughout the industry. And everybody, like you said, Sherry, everybody has their own little detail. Everybody has their own story about building a house and getting the warranties. But from what I'm gathering, Ryan is extremely aggressive on this, and they are national. 14 states. They're in 14 different states.
James, this is great. Thanks for your just great work on this. You've done great work on the Portsmouth investigation. This is our first time to have you on. If our listeners want to find you on Twitter, where can they find you?
At James Pilcher, all one word.
James Pilcher, JamesPilcher.
That's right.
James Pilcher, at James Pilcher on Twitter. Give him a follow. A top investigative reporter, doing great work. And you've got a couple other things in the hopper right now as well, so we'll look forward. So
thanks.
Definitely give him a follow. Let's go now. Let's shift now to bringing in our – we brought a guest in from the newsroom. Now we're going to bring a guest in from – actually from Columbus. The registrar of the Ohio BMV, Charlie Norman, who is a Cincinnati native. He will not like the fact that I will say he's a UC graduate because he's a huge Xavier basketball fan. But a Cincinnati native and just became the registrar of the Ohio Department of Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles, the place where you go get your driver's license and your license plates. Under Governor Mike DeWine. So let's bring Charlie in. All right, the interview segment time here on the special guest interview segment time here on the TSC. As I mentioned earlier, we'll welcome in my good friend, and we hope yours, the registrar of the BMV of the state of Ohio, Charlie Norman. Charlie, how are you?
Good. Who doesn't love the BMV?
You just stole my line. So I'm so glad.
Sherry, jump right to it.
I'm so glad you're here. Did you bring my plate sticker? My birthday's next week.
Did you renew yet?
No.
Oh, well, you know, just as an aside, Sherry, you can do that online.
Yes. All right. So, that is actually good to know.
Yes.
I was just kidding. I wouldn't expect special treatment, even though both Jason and I have known you a very long time. You did get your start in Cincinnati.
I did.
From here.
Well, that's right. And I'm mentioned in the first segment that you are a Cincinnati native, a UC, proud UC graduate. I said you wouldn't like that because you're a big Xavier basketball fan.
I like to mix it up.
Cincinnati through and through. LaSalle High?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I was a little nervous about getting that one right. But a long time, you've long known Governor Mike DeWine for a long time. You did. You were the chief of staff for his son, Pat DeWine, when he was a Hamilton County commissioner. Can you talk a little bit about getting the job itself? And
sure.
You had previously worked for the Hamilton County Board of Elections, and then after Governor DeWine was elected, you moved on to Columbus.
Right. So as you mentioned, so I've worked in a sort of a lot of levels of government here in Hamilton County, at the local level for the city of Cheviot, for Commissioner DeWine in the courthouse, right, Sherry?
Yes.
Good times. Mm-hmm. Worked for Governor DeWine when he was Attorney General DeWine. So
that's right. Yep.
Down in the southern part of the state, regional director. So I sort of covered 11 counties down here. And then back to Hamilton County at the Board of Elections, which was where I was at prior to this position. So back in January, I got a call from the governor. I was actually in the shower. And
were you having a shower beer? one of my pleasures in life, shower beer.
I was getting ready to go up to Columbus for an election officials conference, actually. And my wife says, well, your phone's ringing. And I would say, okay, well, it's, you know, what do you want me to do? I'm in the shower. And she said, well, it's Mike DeWine. And I said, okay, I'll get out of the shower. And we just started chatting about this position. And he said, hey, can you come up and talk about this today? So I found myself on my way to London, Ohio, up to BCI to talk about running the BMV, which is, you know, I didn't have any BMV experience other than as a customer. But I don't think the governor viewed that as a negative. I think it was he wanted a fresh set of eyes.
Yeah,
to take a look at the agency, and within 2 weeks, I had moved up to Columbus.
You,
I have to say, I was talking to someone. I'm not going to reveal their name, but they were like, "Okay, I said that you were going to be the guest," and they said, "You know, he could run anything, and in 6 months, it would be running the most efficient that it ever has been. He could be running Procter & Gamble; it would be doing the best it ever did within 6 months. He could be running a hospital; same thing." And that was that person's comment.
Tell me who that is after when we're off the air, so I can.
Well, that's something you've done right out of the gate. Is that as the registrar of the BMV? I always want to say DMV, but
some states have DMVs.
Yes, they do. Yeah. One of the things you've done already, you've looked and you've seen that we were behind, we being the state of Ohio, we're behind some in the technology area, the customer service. This is such a customer service job, really, that you're in. And one of the things you've done, you launched in June, basically you can renew your license.
It's okay.
It's a pilot program you're starting here in Hamilton. You started here in Hamilton County. What is that? Sorry.
No, you're good. It's we call it Get In Line Online.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
You know, the concept is, you know, it's sort of actually it's you can do this at Great Clips, right, or Outback. So, you know, we know lines are a problem. We know wait times are a problem. So the way Get In Line Online works is you can go to our website. There are 13 pilot agencies, one here in Hamilton County over in Green Township. And you can see live wait times, so you can sort of make an informed decision about which office you want to go into. And you can also reserve a spot in line.
Oh, nice.
So you go in, you know you got to go to the BMV, you wake up. You at 8 a.m., you log in, you choose your office, and at that point, you have a four-hour window. And from then on, you are, after you've reserved your spot, you're advancing through the queue as if you were there in the office waiting.
Gotcha.
So you have 4 hours, you take your kids to school, go get a cup of coffee, come into the office, get some work done, so all while you're advancing through the queue. Then when you go to the office, you check in the kiosk that lets them know you're there, and you sort of claim your spot in line.
You just skip the line,
essentially. Yeah, yeah.
How is that? Do you see that? How is that going? And do you see that becoming a statewide program?
Really good. We're getting some really good feedback from the users. People seem to like it. We know from the data we've got back that the folks who queue in online save between 60% and 80% on their wait times.
Wow.
An interesting side to this is because we have this the queuing online and the kiosks and sort of the entire software system, we're able to tell for the first time what wait times are.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we never knew. We had no way of measuring it besides sort of anecdotal, you know, well, this place is slow, this place is fast. So we can use that as an evaluation tool and to improve our own processes. And the deputy registrar can use it as a management tool to, you know, train their staff and sort of refine their work areas. So it's been great. And even the people who don't queue in online. So the other part of this is, you know, you're checking in at a kiosk. And you're just taking a seat and waiting to be called. So it gets rid of that snake line, that sort of cattle call where you're standing there waiting. And so it has, you know, there's a benefit for everyone, even those who don't queue in online. It's a calmer atmosphere. You can sit down. You can look at your phone. You can read a book. Really good feedback so far. We are
So do the clerks run them? Because if you look at them, it has Aftab Purival's name on it, the clerk of Hamilton County.
So the clerk runs the title offices in Ohio.
I see.
Yes.
And before
they're
jump,
in the same spot in some places.
In some places, yeah.
Okay.
Before we jump to other subjects, what's the website to go to do that?
bmv.ohio.gov.
bmv.ohio.gov.
Right. And there's a get in line online image on the front page, and you sort of click that. We are really optimistic that we're going to be able to roll this out statewide within the next few months.
So really? Great. Will that be mentioned when you get the letter in the mail every year to renew your license? Will that be part of
it? Is we're
the language in
we're
there.
Sort of pushing it every chance we get. Now it's limited because not every agency has it right now.
Yeah.
So we're sort of limited in how we can communicate that, but yeah, we're certainly pushing as much as we can. We see that the numbers have gone up week after week as more people find out about it. It's just sort of organically more people find out about it.
Another big thing that you've really tackled here early on is the what you call the real ID, and that's a question a lot of people have about, you know, do I have the right ID for, you know, because come next year, what is it, October 2020?
October 1st, 2020, yeah.
You have to have this ID to be able to fly, correct?
Correct.
And so what is that and so what
should
people do?
Back in 2005, Congress passed something called the Real ID Act, and that was a response to a recommendation in the 9/11 Commission report. It was, you know, the terrorists had any number of state IDs that were fraudulently issued,
mm-hmm.
And use those to get on planes. And so I think the federal government started to take a look at, well, how do states issue driver's licenses? And as you can probably imagine, there are 50 different ways to do it. So the Real ID Act created these national standards for states for the issuance of driver's license and IDs. And Ohio started issuing real ID compliant driver's licenses in July of last year.
Gotcha.
Everyone's going to wait to the last minute.
It's an issue nationwide. I can tell you, I just had a meeting with Department of Homeland Security last week. Nationwide, real ID compliance is at about 27%.
It's because you need so many. I'm not blaming you. It's because you need so many forms of ID. I grabbed the wrong thing when I went to get my actual license last year because I thought I would get it, and then I didn't have it. And then after I waited in the line, like 50 people, I was like, I'll just get the regular license and come back for the real ID a different time.
Sure. And that's interestingly, so you're required to prove five things, right? Your full legal name, your date of birth, your social security number, your legal presence, and two proofs of your Ohio residence. Those are all the documents that you're required to produce when you get an initial driver's license in Ohio. So it's
that
the
was
same.
A while ago, yes. For Justin and I.
Same here.
Ooh, did you pass your driver's test on the first time, Jason?
No, but you know what? I do have to ask you this because I bought a canoe and I still haven't gotten my license. Do I have to have a license for my canoe?
Kayak, yes.
Sorry, my kayak.
I don't think so.
Yes, you do.
Do you?
Yes. If you get stopped, you could get a ticket for not having it.
Phil's nodding his head.
Oh, there
yes.
you go.
Does that go through I don't know if that's a BMV thing.
It has to be a title thing.
I bet that's a title thing, yeah. You would know that if it was going
to. You're supposed to carry it with you. Now, to be fair, I actually don't do that part, but I do have one.
Anyway, so Real ID, just so people know, you got to fly, you've got to have this. Otherwise, you can still get just a regular state-issued ID, which is...
You can get a state regular driver's license ID. There's no difference in cost between the two, so we're not certainly not making any money off this. In fact, it takes 3 to 5 times as long for us to process a Real ID transaction as it does a standard because of all that we have to scan all the documentation and we're pinging different systems to check things. So you can still get that, and it's still good for boating and driving and buying alcohol. But if you want to get on an airplane after October 1st, 2020, you've got to have a Real ID compliant license. Get on an airplane, get into a federal building, get onto a military base.
Oh, that's good to know.
I'm adding this to my to-do list now. And I feel like I could cross it off by October 2020 if I start now.
So say one of our reporters had to go cover something at the federal courthouse. They would need the Real ID to get in there for...
Yeah, it's secure federal buildings, okay. So it's going to be a little... Different federal buildings will have different standards.
Okay.
But yeah, in theory, that could happen, sure. And so we really want people, you know, like Sherry mentioned, you need some extra documentation. So best thing you can do is, again, go to our website, bmv.ohio.gov, follow that prompt for Real ID. We have an interactive checklist that you can use to make sure you're bringing everything you need.
It was actually super helpful unless you grab your child's social security card instead of your own.
I got a couple before
you might find you need fewer documents than you think. Like a passport, for instance, proves 3 elements. So
do you think there's any chance that the government might move the needle? Because a lot of times when we roll out big things like this,
there's a chance.
They do that.
People are slow.
I mean, it is the Real ID Act of 2005. but now I think 48 states are issuing. 2 are about to start issuing. You know, they could. Like I said, at 27%, states have a lot of work to do. In Ohio, we're at about 30%. There are some states in the single digits. So,
I want to ask you a couple more things. Is there any couple fun things? But is there anything else in terms of kind of that customer service improvement, best practices that you're working on currently right now that you could share?
Yeah. One thing we're really proud of is some work we've already done with our call center. So when I came in January, if you called the BMV with a question about your driver's license or registration or something, your average wait time was 26 minutes on the phone. Oof. And this is something we have a governor who's intensely interested in customer service.
Good.
And this is something he came in, saw our operation, and it bothered him and it bothered me. And that said, we knew just going out and hiring a bunch of operators wasn't an option. We have our own fiscal problems to deal with. So, you know, we kind of just had to think through it. Got my staff together. You know, it's interesting. When I first came on board, I got my senior staff together and I said, you know, let's give me some ideas. Give me some things you've always wanted to do, but you never could because of political problems, budget problems, or just institutional obstinacy.
Red tape,
Let's see what we can do. And to their credit, I mean, they had some really good ideas, and I think I've always found that's the case, is, you know, the people down working, doing the actual work have great ideas, but generally no one asks them what they are. So, I mean, and so they just sort of thought through this problem. We changed our call trees. We created separate queues for some of our problem calls that we knew were going to take longer. We pushed people to online services that are available. Mm-hmm. We changed some of our messaging on our waits. And then finally, we instituted an interactive voice recognition system that really started to drive the number down. And so that people can get to where they need to be faster and in some cases – conduct business without speaking to an operator. So I get a report every week. Last week, if you called that same number, your wait time was 3 minutes and 4 seconds. And that's a pretty drastic drop. I don't think we're done. I think it's going to get a little better. But those are the kind of things we're working on. We have actually something really neat coming up in 2020, the next few months. So our method for doing driver's exams has been the same for 50 years. You know, the guy gets in your car, he's got a clipboard and a pencil, right?
Yeah.
You go around in the circle. You're checking a box, pass, fail. It's really hard to believe we still do it like that. We were able to secure some grant money from the federal government. So, and starting in 2020, that old clipboard system is gone. We'll be doing tablet-based turn-by-turn driver examination, gives instant feedback to the prospective licensee. We can track and evaluate our examiners as well to make sure they're doing a good job. So we're really, really excited about that as well. And it'll streamline a lot of our processes as well.
One other thing, I just thought of this, and I knew this was a story or something. It was an issue. It was sometime after you came on, and it didn't have anything to do with you, but the issue of, what was it, like the face recognition, sure, the privacy issue. When people say, what are you doing with my information? What do you tell them?
Which information in particular?
I don't remember the story.
Maybe it was in the Washington Post. I can't remember that some states were selling driver's license data.
Yeah, I think that was it. Yes.
Yeah, which we don't do. Some of your data is public record.
Correct.
You know, so your insurance company, for instance, you know, they can ask, how many wrecks has Jason been in, right?
Yep.
So to the extent we're required to give public records out, we do, but we don't sell driver's license photos, for instance. We don't we don't provide any driver's license photos bulk to the federal government. Law enforcement may contact us for a photo, and at that, you know, those are one-offs, you know, that we provide, you know, and they have to attest that it's part of a legitimate, you know, law enforcement use. But we're not sort of bulk providing photos for anyone.
Gotcha. You know, you and I have known each other for a long time. We get together and chat, and I know you and Sherry have known each other for a while too. You've told me some really fun stories, and one of those is you visited the license plate. I call it the license plate factory, but it's inside the Lebanon Correctional Facility here in Greater Cincinnati, where all the license in the state of Ohio are made by inmates.
That's correct.
What was that visit like for you? And
that's such a cliche.
Yeah,
the license plate. I didn't realize that was real.
Yeah, I didn't either until you and I, a few months ago. Charlie and I grabbed a beer, and you were telling me the story about how you visited, and it was a neat story.
It is. These guys. It's a sought after position at the prison. It's something you go and it's really impressive to see. I mean, the volume is pretty impressive. And they are literally stamping plates. They're also creating the temporary tags.
Okay.
So there are these old printers that are running these things, and there are guys, inmates there, they're learning a skill. They're being paid. It's not a ton of money, obviously.
Do you know how much they get paid?
Oh, gosh. I couldn't tell you. It's Ohio Penal Industries.
Okay.
Right. But, it's a sought after position because it's something to do. You're learning a skill. And you go through, and some of those guys are not there for very long. Mm-hmm. And some of them are there. They're going to be there for a long, long time. It was really interesting to see, sort of, there are two sides to it. So there's the what you might imagine, where there's, you know, a big press, stamping, you know, those plates, and the that's happening, and they're moving the paddles around that have the numbers on them, and you know, pulling the big hydraulic press down. And then there's another side where all of your personalized plates and your, let's say, your Cincinnati Bengals plates or your Reds plates or Xavier University's plates.
Yeah.
So those are made on a giant, or UC.
Bearcats.
A giant printer. It's called the Raptor, and it's spitting those things out, yeah, you know, one by one. And that's also, you know, operated by these guys. It's really impressive.
Did you get a chance to talk to any of the guys?
I did. And, you know, it's a sense of purpose too.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and, you know, I think, to a T, the ones we spoke with, I mean, they really enjoyed the opportunity to do this. Yeah.
What was I going to say? Has that been there for a long time?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Quite and a while.
Can, if you're in the public, can you tour that, or do you know, or?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the warden.
Guess no.
Okay. Yeah.
When you go to, like, I mean, every once in a while you have to do an inmate interview.
Yeah.
It is a very involved process to get inside a prison. I don't feel like that's probably a thing.
But I mean, you're Jason Williams. You could probably.
And I'm a nobody. That.
But let's talk about the personalized plates, because I want to know about the controversial ones. And like, is there like in the process where the ones that are really in question come right to your desk and you have to make the decision?
So they don't come right to my desk, but I have there are four folks who sit downstairs and every morning go over the list they receive from the deputy registrar's office. And
that sounds so fun.
This is a family podcast, so I can't say some of the things that are...
Phil, you can bleep them out, right? Can you think of some good Cincinnati ones? Let's start with easy.
Cincy
plates?
Well, hang on a second. So the four folks, they're going over, are they reviewing all the requests or just the ones that are kind of been flagged as like, ooh?
Right. These are the ones that have been flagged at your local office.
Okay. Like, ooh, I don't know if we can do that or not. Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. Something that catches their eye, they send it. And then these four look, do a little research. You know, we get a lot of Urban Dictionary definitions, some more graphic than others. Some Cincinnati ones we get all the time. Everyone thinks of the first person to think of the Bengals B plate, and then letters ITCHES. You can figure that one out, right?
Okay.
People are creative. They write things backwards. You know, they use fives for S's, for instance. Ass is in any number of different ways.
You want to drive around with that on your license plate.
Right? I mean, and different registrars, I think, have handled this issue differently. And I'm of the opinion, and there's some court decisions that guide us on this. But, you know, unless it's overtly vulgar, I just think you can't save people from themselves.
Have you ever had to revoke one that slipped through?
We do get complaints and that ask us for a reconsideration. I don't know that I have yet. But we do get those requests and so they, I generally leave it to my staff. I don't want to, you know, intrude in their process. They do this every day and I don't. I get the appeals when people request, you know, reconsideration.
If you see something you don't like when you're out driving on I-71 and, you know, I'm just a Joe Schmo driver and I see this and they'll call into your office.
Yep.
And so is that when it becomes that official complaint, you start to review that unknown to that person's plate?
Yeah, so those same four people will review that. They'll get a history of the plate. Has this been issued anywhere else? At any other times? You know, they'll do a little research into what the word might mean, and then it'll come up to us.
So that brings us to 2020. I mean, that brings us to politics.
Yes.
And I'm sure, do you get a lot? You know, there was a... there's probably quite a few license plates were Trump supporters.
Sure.
I think you and I have talked about this. Do those also get flagged, or political ones, even one way or the other?
They get flagged.
They do. Okay. Regardless, if it
right, And we have taken the position under, at least since I've been there, that's a First Amendment issue. We shouldn't be telling people yes or no. So, and we'll get the complaints as well. So someone complains from both sides. So we got a complaint over a resist plate. We got a complaint over a, you know, MAGA 2020. We got a complaint over a fake news plate, actually. And people say, yeah, take, you know, we want this, this is offensive, and it's, you know.
That is somebody who feels very strongly. I feel like that, or the other ones you're talking about, like that you feel that strongly that you want to put on your license plate. Like,
and you're paying
I
want
to go to the license plate. Yeah. Like, I want to go to the DMV and just get my plate and go.
Right.
But you, it becomes a First Amendment issue then. Do you have a lawyer on your staff that looks at these things?
We do. And like I said, he's, you know, they've provided some guidance to us, both about our process for reviewing these, but also there's some court cases, that give us some guidance on how what we can and can't approve.
When you talk about complaints, are we talking about like a few a day, or are you talking?
No, it's pretty rare, you know, once they're issued.
Okay, so it's pretty rare to get a complaint.
Yeah.
So, like, if somebody has resist or MAGA 2020, you're not hearing a lot about. You're not getting just bombarded by.
No, not a
calls.
Ton. Okay. I mean, it's maybe at least not that come up to me. Maybe one a month, let's say.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not much.
Gotcha.
I mean, you know, people have their own problems. As much as I think some of these are silly, I can't imagine being that annoyed by someone else's license plate.
That you would call.
Yeah.
Right.
Is your license plate Registrar 1?
No.
What should Jason's plate be?
Nothing. Whatever
it's
it is.
Nothing now, but let's pick one for you.
The three letters and the random numbers they gave me. That's all my license plate should be.
That's an idea. Yeah.
I still got the plates with the farm.
Oh, the beautiful Ohio plates.
Beautiful Ohio plates.
Yes. Those were under Governor Strickland. So we still have, I think, maybe six series of license plates out there on the road.
How do you decide to do a new one? Because Colorado's doing a new one right now. They're reversing the sky in the mountains.
Yeah. It's a governor initiative. And so.
Well, in Kasich, I think, just did the mm-hmm. one with the red top.
Red, white, yep.
That just, what was that, 17 maybe?
Oh,
put
gosh.
That in, 16?
I don't remember. We have plates going all that on the road still, going all the way back to Governor Voinovich.
Oh, really? Okay.
There's sort of the gold gradient plate.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. And as it, like, they have the county name kind of in a big sticker on the
some
bottom.
Some of them are pretty funky. You know, the American Association of Motor Vehicles says, you know, a plate life should be about 10 years. And we're you know,
Voinovich
double that.
Voinovich, I think, was a little longer than that. I'm just
what
guessing.
Was, so, you know, like, the county they put the county stickers on the newest plates, mm-hmm. but those hadn't been around for a long time. Does that matter? Like, what is the significance of having like Gallia County or Hamilton County on your plate? Is that
so you can be mad at someone from their out of town?
Yeah, like what is there? Is that
so? That
is there
was
a purpose to that? Or is it
they
more
used
of a
to be on there.
Thing?
They used to be on there. They came off.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, and they came off.
And then I believe Speaker Rosenberger brought those back several years ago. I suppose law enforcement likes them.
Okay.
You know, they want to. It makes it easier. And of course, you have the number stickers as well.
Yeah.
Those can be hard to read.
Yeah.
So it may give them a sense of, you know, whether a car is from that county or not.
Does not having the front license plate make your, like, the whole BMV's job easier?
No, not particularly. The way that legislation was written, we still have to provide the option for a front plate. So it actually complicates it quite a bit for us. We've got to maintain.
Do people choose that?
We'll find out.
Okay.
It's not until July of next year.
So July of next year is when the optional front plate kicks in.
Oh, next year's going to be so much fun for you guys.
Oh, yeah. We can't wait. So we've got a stock, separate stocks. We've got inventory and auditing issues with sort of maintaining those separate plates. And it's going to be a hassle, but we'll make do.
I have one more question for you, and it's kind of a fun one. You're a Cincinnatian living in Columbus.
Yes.
And a Cincinnatian through and through. Is it real that Cincinnati Columbus thing? We've talked about that on the podcast before, like that Columbus sort of looks at us as being down there on an island by ourselves, and we kind of look at them as thinking about us like that we're second class citizens. What have you living there? Any thoughts on that whole thing?
Yeah, I think it's real.
Really?
But I think it goes both ways. So it's interesting. I just think about some of the when we try to pitch stories down here and we can't get any traction, and that's sort of legendary among the, you know, the public information staff up there.
I've never heard that.
we can't get anyone to pick this up in Cincinnati. And I think part of it is when we're down here, we feel like we've got our own scandals and our own and our own scoundrels, and we don't have time for, you know, this nonsense up in Columbus. And on the flip side, yeah, I think sometimes we can get forgotten.
Yeah.
So
I've always just been kind of fascinated by the whole state of Cincinnati thing down here on the island, like that the rest of the state kind of sees us a little bit as, they're part of Kentucky down there. And we got a little bit of a chip on our shoulder down here for that. And yet we don't want to think of ourselves as Kentucky, and Northern Kentucky feels much the same way as Cincinnati.
No, it is. It is like an island. No, and a news island, too. I mean, we have two amazing Columbus reporters, of course, but they're only two people. And at times we've had one person. And so that gets hard. And then I think our other major news are like television stations without statehouse reporters. Mm-hmm. And like as the ranks thin, I think that is, it does make it difficult to get to everything in Columbus. And we do have a lot of news down here. I wouldn't have it any other way.
You can always call me, you know.
I will now. I feel like I need a list of these controversial blades. This seems like a good story.
That's public records.
It does.
All right. So, and you can make public records requests verbally. So here we go.
Yeah. Charlie, this has been fun. Thanks for coming down from Columbus and sitting down with us here in the studio. It's always great to see you. And
I actually learned a lot. Like this was like, as much as we do talk, like I don't ask you questions like this. I learned a lot here. Like that Ohioans need to know.
You know, thanks for all that you're doing. And, you know, certainly as a citizen of Ohio, making this stuff more customer friendly is so critical. And so thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity. We got a lot to talk about. And it's hard to, you know, get people to listen about the BMV. I get it. So any opportunity I have to share the story we have, I'm really appreciative.
Okay, thanks to Charlie Norman for coming down from Columbus. It was a great chat with him. Also, thanks again to James Pilcher for swinging over from his desk and giving us some great insight. I'm really excited about his story coming up and the work that he's doing there. We're going to switch gears. What do you got? Sherry's ready to pounce here.
Well, this is usually when we talk about our That So Cincinnati moment, but I'm going to just switch it up a little bit here, okay? And I want to call it our That So Gallopolis. No, I'm just kidding.
Gallopolis?
Yeah, I never know how to pronounce your hometown.
Gallopolis. Or Gallopolis. Either ones are accepted. Gallopolis or Gallopolis are both accepted.
So, of course, I've mentioned before, I sit next to Jason, and Jason visited his hometown to write about Trump country, and he wrote a column, which I know you've all read, but the reaction to it has been fascinating. It's kind of still rolling in. We're 2 weeks later. He went there like 3 weeks ago. It was really just great reporting, illuminated a lot of, you know, what people who support the president are thinking, and as we go into really, you know, gear up for the next presidential election. And so I wanted to talk to you about what the response was that you got to that, because this is just, it's real people responses, and I want to hear about this.
I'll tell you, it's been overwhelming, and I say that in a good way. the tremendous positive response. I was really braced for I was kind of braced for it to be really a negative response, and it's been overwhelmingly positive. And the thing that I think surprised me the most is that I've gotten a lot of responses from Democrats saying, "Yeah, this is what we should be doing. Going to Trump country. My hometown is in Southeast Ohio, and you think about the rural area of this state that Trump really won, and that basically extends Southern Ohio from Claremont County all the way over to Gallia County, which is where I'm from, and then up all the way up to the Mahoning Valley. So it's kind of this backward L shape in the state of Ohio that is really all of Trump country. And, you know, I've had, four or five Democrats tell me, look, we've been trying to tell our party leaders to go there and, you know, talk, you know, push the message of jobs, 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 and more jobs. Sort of the Sherrod Brown model of doing things. And Sherrod has won a lot of counties in that area, or he's closed the gap. And last year he did. He didn't win all of Southeast. He didn't really win Southeast Ohio, but he didn't get beat as badly as most Democrats have been getting beat since 2016. And so jobs are a message that both the Republican and Democratic Party are very core to both of them. And so it makes sense, especially when you're going into a blue collar area. Why can't Democrats make more inroads there? Well, it's because they've given up on it. They gave up on it a long time ago. They're not following the Sherrod Brown model. And as my conversation with some of those people, they were letting me know, they've been frustrated by it. That it's almost like the Democratic Party has dismissed that. I do know that David Pepper, we had him on one of our episodes early. I know he has worked and tried to make some more inroads and develop more relationships there. But I think it's a long game that you've got to start to really peck away and get Democrats elected to, you know, some of these trustee seats, to these little town and village council seats, and you got to build it up from there, and then you got to spend a lot of money and going out there and mailing and putting people on the ground. And one of the challenges one of the Democrats told me was, this was someone from Columbus telling me that part of it is that the houses are so spread out there, across a rural area.
I know. And so you think about the door knocking efforts we see here. It's
exactly.
It's easy. Everything, you know, you get like 20 houses on a block.
Yeah. And then so that, and then Rush Limbaugh picked it up and talked about it on his show. And it was kind of an interesting. He spent several minutes talking about the column.
Also, he described you as
a left-wing Democrat. It was very odd because he seemed to be praising the column, but then somewhere in the middle of his diatribe, he just is like, only a left-wing Democrat could write this. And it was kind of like, I didn't realize this was written. I wasn't coming from either way, either side here. I was coming to tell the truth about my hometown. And yeah, that was interesting. I think the most heartwarming thing is that my mom and dad got a handwritten letter from one of my teachers growing up, Mrs. Slagle, who know my parents from my mom is a retired teacher, and they're in retired teachers, some kind of retired teachers organization together. But for them to Mr. and Mrs. Slagle to write a handwritten letter just to say, hey, we really love this and this is great and congratulations, your son writing this piece, was just a pretty cool thing.
And I feel like that says a lot about your hometown and who they are. They're the kind of, you know, that's the kind of town where people know each other and they write letters like that. They remembered you. I mean, to be fair, I feel like you're probably pretty unforgettable. But here's what I want to know. Like when you were in high school, like did they just have to tell you to be quiet all the time? You're a talker like I am. I was constantly in trouble for talking.
I wasn't constantly in trouble, but when I did get in trouble, it was for talking, yes.
Okay.
It wasn't for doing anything really nutso or crazy or, you know, going out at lunchtime and...
Oh, yeah, no, we're not. I don't think either
partaking
one of us
in substances or anything
really
like that.
Like, no.
Like others in my friend group did at times. But
my parents were strict. Like, we didn't really step a toe out of line.
I know this probably also doesn't surprise you, but I was a very, very intense. So, like, I was pretty locked in as a student. And I was one of the students that I couldn't just breeze through. I had to study hard to get good grades, so I worked hard at it, and so I had to stay focused. I couldn't be partaking in a lot of shenanigans during the week.
How were you in math class?
Awful.
Me too.
And it's funny you mentioned that because my son, first grader, just got his first report card of the year. And yeah, the math thing is.
I know when Jack asked me, Jack, 11 years old, fifth grade, like when he needs help with his math homework, I'm like, where's your dad?
math was I probably shouldn't. I don't. It doesn't even matter. It's funny. I was considered not college prep technically by my high school because I decided for my third math credit to take instead of like algebra or trigonometry or something. I decided to take, or no, calculus.
I don't know where this is going. Go ahead.
I decided instead of taking calculus because I'm like, man, I struggled through algebra one. I barely got through geometry. And I'm like, all right, I need something that's more practical here. I took consumer math. And it's amazing to think the two classes, and so they
considered. Yeah, helpful, I bet.
Like, you know, balancing checkbooks, basic math. I mean, yeah. It was like. And so it's funny to look back in high school and think the two classes that I got the most out of were, and probably that I carry on today, and obviously I think English too. I had great English teachers. My mom also was an English teacher. But were typing and consumer math. To both things
oh
that we
God.
Used.
Oh my God, did you type as hard as you type now
yeah,
when
did.
You were in okay.
I did. I took typing one and two. So I took the advanced typing
anybody
class.
Who's ever been around Jason reporting will say the same thing. He types on his computer super hard.
I've been told by a colleague of ours that if I don't stop doing that, I'll end up getting stress fractures in the tips of my fingers.
I always know a good the harder he bangs on the computer, the better the column's going to be.
Oh, certainly the more locked in and focused that I am is the harder
I'm getting. Yeah,
it's never, it's not like it's, I'm doing it. Just how I am. Like I just
with your marching band music.
With my marching
okay.
band. Well, that's another episode. Let's talk about you. What do you got? You got anything exciting?
I'm so bad at math. During the last budget cycle, someone, I won't say who at the city, I was like, you don't have to do all that for me. I feel terrible. I was like, that's my job to do. And they're like, we prefer it to be right, Sherry. We're the math for you. It's like, ouch.
I remember we had an editor here. I came here in, May of 2012, and one of our editors, he's like, I told him best of this something really basic and a basic percentage, and a reader called me out on it and then forwarded it to this editor, and he just said, like, he's like, you absolutely suck at math. Yeah.
Editors, they tend to break it down.
Yes, he wasn't wrong. So that's why we always have to triple. That was his thing. He's like, triple and quadruple check your math, and if you got to run it by two or three people, then do it.
That's right. Alex Coolidge, James Calhoun, and Dan Horn. Those are the three people.
Well, there we
Thank
go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Those are all of our. Well, Jim Calhoun is. We have not had him on the podcast, but those others we have, and Jim is one of the backbone.
Absolutely.
Of this organization, and he deserves certainly a credit for that. A guy who's been a copy editor here for a long time and cleans up so much. And
that's not his job anymore,
no.
But he will still save your butt at night.
Plans our print edition headlines. Thanks, Jim, for all you do for us and for the Inquirer and Cincinnati.com. All right. I think we've exhausted this episode. Thanks, by the way. Thank you to those of you out there who have emailed me. I've seen them. I haven't had a chance to get back. I'm really backed up because of my Trump country thing. And
I saw a huge pile of mail on your desk.
But thank you. I've seen it. I will get back with you. Thank you so much for the email. Keep emailing us. jwilliams@inquirer.com.
Suggestions. Welcome.
Guest suggestions welcome. I know one person has emailed me, said he wants to talk about that. Sharon, Sherry is scoolidge@inquirer.com. She's also at Sharon Coolidge on Twitter. I'm at J Williams Cincy with a Y. I know that always bothered Paul Daner, but it's Cincy with a Y, Paul. And
that is a conversation for another podcast, and that's happening since he should be with a Y.
Exactly. C-I-N-C-Y. That's the UC chant, cheerleader chant. Why'd you laugh?
Nothing.
Oh, you remember the story when I tried out for UC cheerleading?
Okay, we're good.
I did. I told you about that, right?
I don't think I know this.
Yeah, I tried out and I didn't make it.
My God, this is like 100 podcasts of discussion. Sorry. I'm so excited.
Anyway.
I'm taking notes.
Make sure to check out this, our latest insane.com, all access digital subscriptions. And we will we'll be right back here in the same time, in the same spot, same name, same executive producer, and same co-host. Hopefully the same other co-host, me. Next week. Sorry. Next week. Thanks.